were just telling me about whether the campus had been blacked out, and I think our tape ran out. So before we continue, this is Karen Saul. We're continuing Frank Baumann's oral history. This is January 30, 2006, and this is tape four, side one of the tape recordings, the second tape that we've made today. So please go ahead and tell me what is happening on the Stanford campus.
The attack at Pearl Harbor, Karen, Mrs. Salt, touched the campus immediately. We've already talked about the response of students to enter the services and to play a role commensurate with their abilities in the war. But at the same time, the military itself looked upon Stanford as a potential target area, and the Army established anti-aircraft bases around the campus with soldiers manning the anti-aircraft guns. And as for the school being blacked out at night, I do not want to overstate my knowledge of that time. I'll be truthful with you. Studies continued at night. The library was open and so forth. And I would say, but I might be in error, that Stanford was an island where there was some light because of the student activities. However, roads were blacked out. San Francisco, much of it was blacked out, an exception being the approach to the Bay Bridges, which had a humorous aspect. That was an ineffective blackout, with the lights on the bridges being available to see from the air. Also at that time, you had this extraordinary movement by our British allies, and I can remember going up to San Francisco in the spring of 1942 and staying in Pacific Heights at Pacific Avenue Laguna on the sixth floor with a Mr. and Mrs. Benjamin Boas, who were the mother and father of my closest Stanford friend, Roger Boas, whom I have a Christian Science background. I met at the Stanford organization in the fall of 1939, and his parents were scientists. And Roger is one of our heroes of World War II. He holds a Silver Star for his efforts with General Patton in the Third Army, and was involved in the relief of Bastogne Christmas Day 1944 with a tank outfit. But I can remember looking out in the morning there on a weekend on two or three occasions as guests of the Boases at breakfast time, and seeing these two monsters near Alcatraz Island to the north, number one, the Queen Mary, number two, the Queen Elizabeth, each loading 20,000 servicemen or 40,000 men who had the vote been one vote different in the Congress, probably would not have been available, but loading these young military, these young army men onto those ships.
Now, about when was this?
This would be about March of 1942, to take them to Australia for the defense of Australia, and sailing at 36 knots without escort, because these ships were too fast for escort. And I remember seeing them two or three times that spring in San Francisco Bay. And of course, they were hidden at night, but in the day, they were very self-evident.
When did you become aware that they were relocating Japanese citizens?
Well, I must have known that fairly early on. The facts are these. The order was issued by President Roosevelt as Commander-in-Chief of the services. I don't think there was a congressional resolution, if there was, I'm not aware of it, or a congressional act. The commander of the Pacific Defense for the Army was a General DeWitt. The order went directly to him, and he was the one that carried it out. I suspect that was fairly early on in 1942, but I wouldn't take an oath that it was at that time. It might have been a somewhat later, but we do have this piece of evidence that in 1942, I became aware of the Japanese language programs being carried out by the United States Navy at the University of Colorado in Boulder, north of Denver. And that program was basically the University of California program. And the University of California was one of six universities in the nation teaching Japanese at that time. The other five were the University of Washington, University of Michigan, Cornell and Ithaca, New York, Harvard, and Yale. And the Navy, in looking over its eligible Japanese officers or competent Japanese officers, after Pearl Harbor, discovered it only had 12 officers that adequately spoke Japanese. So Admiral King, the Chief of Naval Operations in Washington, ordered an immediate study of the universities around the country and to find the number one school and to bring it into the services of the United States Navy. And it discovered that the program at the University of California was the best in the nation. It was headed by a lady by the name of Florence Wan, who was the daughter of Presbyterian missionaries, had been raised in Japan and spoke and wrote fluent Japanese. And that program, almost from the inception, was moved to Colorado because of the DeWitt order, and that would have been in 1942.
Was the general feeling with people on the West Coast that was, I'm just curious what public opinion was. Did they support the relocation? I realize now it's been talked
it's
about
debatable.
A lot in recent times, but what was the public opinion then in early 42?
Let me seek as best as I can to answer that question, I hope with some degree of accuracy. But let me return to the movement of the school from Berkeley to Boulder, just for the reason it links up to DeWitt, and I didn't set that out and I apologize, is that the teachers, or what we call sensei, the Japanese word for teacher, were in many instances, if not most instances, of Japanese background. Nisei, which would be second generation Japanese, or Issei, which would be first generation Japanese in the United States. And it was required the school be moved in light of the DeWitt order because of the fact that they were Japanese.
So now, the faculty weren't allowed to stay.
Right.
The faculty had to move to Colorado.
Precisely. And it was clearly in 42. So it was fairly early on. Now, the attitude of the nation, and certainly in the West, I suppose, in candor, built on a degree because of historic prejudice against the Japanese, historic prejudice against the Chinese, and there were laws in the various Western states that they couldn't own real estate, etc. But we won't go into that. But let's take a look at the facts immediately at hand at that time. And the attitude, because of the attack being premeditated on the part of Japanese leadership, being so deadly and being so effective, and our attempt to negotiate with the Japanese, being for naught. And carried on at the very time the attack plans were being prepared, created or added to the hostility directed towards Japan, not China. China was our ally, but certainly against Japan. And I would say that the average citizen vigorously supported the president and General DeWitt.
Were you aware of any students at Stanford who were relocated, Japanese American students?
We had a Japanese student element at Stanford. Some were from Japan. Many were Issei or Nisei and American citizens. And the very first week of the war, the president, Dr. Ray Lyman Wilbur, spoke at a university assembly about what the attitude of Stanford students should be towards the Japanese. And he urged us to treat the Japanese students at Stanford with respect and to look upon them as Stanford family members.
And did that happen?
And to my knowledge, it happened with one exception. I do know of a Japanese gardener, and I don't know his name, and I don't recall where he worked, maybe at one of the fraternities, and it may have happened off campus, came to work within the first 2 or 3 weeks of the war, and his head was bandaged. And I assume that someone had viciously had attacked him improperly physically. But that's the only example. There was a certain humor on the Stanford campus with all of this towards the Japanese. The Delta Kappa Epsilon fraternity across the street from us, the morning after the war began on December 7th, in other words, December 8th, the very day the president was making his memorable address to the joint session of Congress, the Deke Delta Kappa Epsilon fraternity put a Japanese flag out on the front of the house. And then Time magazine told us this a week or two later with reference to the Delta Kappa Epsilon house at the University of California at Berkeley. It put a large sign on the front of its house, and it said, recited, "If you think we're scared, you should see our Tokyo chapter."
Now, were you able to talk with your parents during this time around the war? And I know it wasn't too much longer before you yourself enlisted. Can you tell me about your conversations with your mother and father?
Well, both my mother and father were patriotic members of society. I think devastated by the fact of what had taken place. Mother was a strong supporter of the English. She'd been involved from the summer of 1940 at her Christian Science Church, collecting canned food and particularly clothing for shipment to Great Britain. Dad was very loyal, using his electrical skills. He was involved with the defense program at this Willamette Industries, which I mentioned to you when I came home at Christmas and employed there. And there was a total awareness that I would be involved. I can't remember the exact words, but I must have told him at that time that I was going to try to enlist in the Navy. And I did enlist when I returned to Stanford at the Federal Building in San Francisco. And if memory serves, the date was January 22nd, 1942.
Had you gone home for Christmas?
And I did gone home for Christmas, yes. Yes, I had gone home for Christmas. Very rainy Christmas, not unlike what we're experiencing at this time in Portland.
Had you talked with your folks about whether you would enlist or not?
I'm sure I did. I can't remember the exact word structure, but I'm sure I did. And this would be confirmed when I changed my course in October of 1942, because I do remember calling them on the telephone and getting their approval, but we'll go into change my course in the Navy. But I did enlist in the old V-7 program, which in January of 1942, which permitted a student to continue in university and get his degree, and then upon graduation, which would have been June of 1943, then to take either on the East Coast or the Middle West in Chicago or on the West Coast, I believe it was in the Seattle area, a line officer's course to become a line officer in the Navy. And I dare say that was influenced to a degree by Dr. Wilbur. I mentioned his statement to all of us at this university assembly that to treat our Japanese fellow students as Stanford men. They were largely men. I don't remember any women, but there may have been, but as members of the Stanford family. But at the same time, he urged a degree of caution in enlisting. He said, you're becoming college educated people. He said, you may have a role that's superior than, with all due respect to a man in the trenches, that is more helpful to the cause. And so I would urge you possibly to consider continuing your education and then serving in the services using the skills that you've acquired at Stanford in a constructive way.
So somehow there was a draft still going on, but you were exempted from that because you were students? Or?
I wasn't exempted because I was a student, because students were reached that age, had to register for the draft. There was no exemption in that respect. But I was exempted because I was underage. I forget what the age breaking point was, but it was like 20 or something, and by then I was maybe 19 years of age, something like that.
So when you enlisted in January of 1942, that was used a certain phrase of
V-7, that was the name of the program, okay. Navy V-7 program.
And that was the Navy?
Yes.
And so that allowed you to stay on campus?
Yes.
And I think you had told me earlier that you started feeling increasingly restless after that.
You're absolutely right, yes, yes.
Well, can you explain that a little bit?
Yes, I'll do my best, Karen. I was not comfortable after enlisting in that program. I had joined it, admittedly. I'd been sworn in. I was a reserve in the Navy and permitted to continue to complete my education, maybe subject to further orders by the Navy. But I was still not comfortable at the school. In fact, the whole atmosphere, despite Dr. Wilbur's statement that we should continue possibly, was one of unsettled, in the sense that no decision had been made, but a determination that individually or collectively we should be involved in the near term in the war effort. And that applied to me without question. My grades fell. I was not happy at school. My grade point average fell. And I think that's of some evidence of that concern. And a concrete example would be in September 1942, when I returned for the beginning of my senior year.
This would have been after a summer of working in the shipyards?
Summer at Vancouver, yes. And incidentally, I earned by the standards of day a fairly sizable sum, and I came back to Stanford for the first time that fall on a relatively sound basis in terms of tuition and all that is required at the school. Well, anyway, I had a car, too, which I'd paid $150.
What kind was it?
I think it was a Plymouth, probably a 1932 Plymouth coupe. And I had a date, and I had a friend, probably a fraternity brother, and myself with a date, and we went over to the next little town to just on the San Jose side of Stanford, called Mayfield, to get some gas for the car with our dates. It was in the evening. I forget where we were going. And at that time, you had gas rationing. You mentioned rationing earlier. And a coupon would give you 5 gallons of gas. So we turned the coupon over to the attendant, and he puts in 5 gallons of gas. But he says to the two boys, he said, "You boys or you men should be in the service." And I forget what our response to the gentleman was, but mentally I knew he was absolutely right. Ruined the evening. I know it was a deplorable evening from the point of view of enjoyment. And this increased my conscious effort to become involved. And a few weeks later, maybe near the end of September, probably the first week or so in October, one of my fraternity brothers, Shorty Granis from Pasadena, a very bright fellow, self-confident, and far more sophisticated than I, told me about, if this is the time to tell you, told me about a Harvard associate professor by the name of A.E. Hindmarsh, who was at the St. Francis Hotel at that very time in San Francisco, interviewing potential members of a naval group that would be attending the Naval Japanese Language School in Boulder, Colorado, headed by Miss Florence Wan, whom I'd already mentioned to you. And I said to Short, I said, "Well, gosh, Shorty, what do we need to do to go up to talk to him?" And Shorty said, "All he wants to see is your transcript, which records your grades and your grade average." And so I called on the registrar's office and got a copy of my transcript and called then Commander Hindmarsh, no longer a professor, and asked for an appointment, made an appointment with him, and somehow got to San Francisco and met with the gentleman. First thing he asks, this is to see my transcript. And he looks it over for seemingly 30 seconds, maybe a minute, and responds, "When do you want to come with us?" And I said, "Well, sir," and then here my parents come in again. I said, "I would like to talk to my parents and see what they say about this." And
so they were, what, like 19 or so at this
Well,
time?
I was a little older than that. This would be in the fall of 42, and I was born in 21, so I would just turn 21 as of June of 42. I was just 21 years of age, but I was 20 when I went into the Navy as first. So I called after leaving Professor, but then I raised one other point with him, if I may set this forward on the table. I said to him, I said, "You know, Professor, I'm very close to getting my Stanford degree. I have a few more units each year than I'm required, and you need 180 units to graduate. I have approximately 165. I have all of my requirements to graduate met. And I said, somehow or other, I would like to join your program, if possible, and at the same time obtain my Stanford degree. And I would like to do this, with your permission, would be to ask for an appointment with Dr. Ray Lyman Wilbur." Incidentally, Dr. Wilbur was Secretary of the Interior. I may have mentioned this in the Hoover administration. And see the gentleman face to face and see if there's some way I can come with you and still graduate from Stanford. And so that evening, I first called my parents, and my parents responded with promptitude and said, "Son, do whatever you think you should, and we'll back you," and which was the indication to go ahead with the program. Number two, I was able to secure an appointment with Dr. Wilbur the very next morning, and a very stern but very fair-minded gentleman. And Dr. Wilbur, after hearing my story, said, "Frank," he said, "you go into that program, and I will personally see to it that you get your Stanford degree."
You were about to learn another language fluently, right?
Yes, we hoped so, yes.
Did you speak anything other than English up to this point?
No, but I'll be perfectly honest with you. I had sat in on some sessions. I don't think I got any credit for this. In the education building, Cumberly Education Building, on the second floor, in some Japanese language sessions. Maybe that was for 2 or 3 weeks or so, but just it was just more or less as an auditor. I don't think I was enrolled in it. I may have been, but I don't think so. But that was my, but, and then of course Latin is not a language, it's of today, but I had had 2 years of Latin in high school from very fine lady, Miss Paranagian. And I'd had a year and a half of Latin at Stanford, too, under a Professor Harriman.
Had you sat in on those Japanese language classes before Pearl Harbor?
No, 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 no. This would be in that September, or 1st of October. No, no. Be fall of 42, I think.
So
I wouldn't take an oath to that, but I think it was clearly before, clearly after Pearl Harbor.
Okay.
Right.
So shortly before.
And I probably saw an announcement or something in the Stanford Daily or something, but I just went in there and. That was my own, but it was a very, very infantile exercise.
So how quickly then did you end up joining the language program?
Well, I informed Professor Heinmarsch, or Commander Heinmarsch, that I'd like to join the program, and I was advised that I was accepted, and he permitted me to finish that fall term, which would be the beginning of my senior year. I then journeyed home at Christmas time in December for a fortnight, returned to Stanford the first part of January to pack my bags, and then did not return home, but then took the train, the old Western Pacific, out of Oakland, up the Feather River Canyon, across the Sierras in Nevada, and to a degree the Colorado Gorge into Denver, lovely trip, and then arrived there on a Sunday at Union Station, and then took a train, of course it was railroad in those days, took a train north to Boulder, about 30, 35 miles of Colorado and Southern, and arrived there Sunday evening.
Did you travel alone, or were there?
Oh, well, I was alone, yes,
okay.
Yes. I had orders, but I had orders, and and I was not in uniform then either.
And was that a naval program?
It was the United States Naval Intelligence Program. Mm-hmm.
What was it that made you think that that was a good place for you? I mean, it was such an unusual thing to do from everything I understand. You were one of just a very few people selected for the program, for one thing, right?
Right, right.
I mean, of all the things that you could do.
They were presumably an upper strata intelligence group from the schools of the country, largely from the Ivy League schools, Harvard and Yale, who were somewhat more sophisticated than the Westerners, a paucity from the Middle West, and even fewer from the South and the Rockies, and then a number from the West Coast, particularly from California, to a lesser extent, Washington, and an even smaller group from Oregon. But there were several Stanford people joining with me at that time, including my friend Shorty Granis, who introduced me to the program. I tended to frequent with those types if they would let me, which was a positive and negative socially, because it to a degree kept me away from certain elements within the school that were, say, engaged in more of the frivolous activities of the school. It was known as a country club in those days, Stanford. I don't know. I was excited by this. I'll be perfectly honest. I was uncomfortable about shooting somebody with a gun, but I still felt I wanted to be in the service and participating the fullest extent possible.
Did it intimidate you, though?